is an investigative journalist at Bloomberg and the author of Flash Crash, A Trading Savant, A Global Manhunt, and the Most Mysterious Market Crash in History. This is Liam Vaughn. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tech. All right. I'm here with Liam Vaughn. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Duncan. It's a pleasure.
There's a book you wrote recently called Flash Crash, and it tells this incredible story of this guy who's sort of a self-taught stock trader who may have crashed the stock market briefly. But before we get into the whole story here, what compelled you to write this book? Why did you find this subject fascinating?
Yeah, so I'm a kind of investigative reporter at Bloomberg in London, and I write, all sorts of stories about financial crime. And a lot of the time you find that the sort of characters that you come across, are interesting in different ways, but a lot of the time you sort of feel like you've heard their story before. So it might be kind of, very well-paid, very well-educated Wall Street type traders, or kind of slightly dodgy characters that maybe screw people out of their their savings or whatever. But, this story, and we'll get to it, the fundamental thing that attracted me to it is just at the center of it is this character, Navinder Sarraw, who was really like nobody else I'd ever heard about and certainly written about in my career as a journalist. He was a sort of walking... Or he is, a bit of a kind of walking enigma. On the one hand, he's this incredibly gifted and brilliant trader who made tens of millions of pounds or dollars from his parents' house. On the other hand, he never spent any of the money. He didn't tell anyone in his kind of circle of friends or his family what he was up to in his bedroom. So most of the people that I write about, I can't wait to tell the world how successful they are or to spend the money. And so, in that sense, he was just really odd. And then there was this whole fantastic other element to the story, which is that Nav was, is a day trader. Essentially, he traded on his own, didn't work for a bank or a hedge fund or anything else. And he always felt like that, the markets were sort of stacked against him, and he would complain about it to the exchanges where he operated and also to the financial regulators. And he specifically had a sort of beef about these participants called high frequency traders. A lot of people think he had a point. And I don't know if you're aware of Michael Lewis's book.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
But Nav, just was such an atypical protagonist for a financial crime story, in so many different ways. But also there was just this whole great subplot about yes, he might have been breaking the law, but maybe a lot of people could understand why he did that. And that gave the story real nuance. And that's the kind of thing that you're looking for when you're doing a book, because, unlike an article, you really have to spend a huge amount of time on this subject, and that has to sort of that passion for the story really has to drive you through. And I can honestly say, hand on heart, even now I'm still just fascinated by Nav, and he remains an enigma to me, even having written 300 pages about him or whatever.
Did you get to talk to him directly at all?
So I would follow him around various court attendances. He was sentenced, but also he gave testimony at other trials. And so I would, bump into him in the corridor or whatever and sort of make small talk, but I didn't get a chance to interview him for the book. The book is as a result of a huge amount of first-hand evidence that I was able to sort of gather, both from the kind of legal side and the investigation side of things, but also, he had quite an active online presence. I also spoke to people from every aspect of his life, from his kind of neighborhood and his home life and his kind of school life through to his early days trading, right up to, to his kind of brokers and the, the people that worked on the investigation. And then at the end of all of that, I was lucky enough to be able to go through a really detailed process of fact checking with Nav via his lawyer, whereby, you know, I essentially sent them a very long document saying, this is what I understand happened, and this is what we're going to include, or I'm going to include in the book. And there was some to-ing and fro-ing at that point, you know, where he would say, no, I don't see it like that, or whatever. And it was very useful as well in terms of getting some more information. So I was able to, you know, to interact with him.
Right.
But unfortunately, you know, I didn't get that moment that I really wanted from the start, which was to sit down face to face with him. But I mean, I should say that the main reason for that is that he remains sort of going through the justice system. And it's not until January of next year that he will finally be a complete free man. So maybe at that point he'll sit down with me.
Well, in some ways it almost, I don't want to say it's better, but it does preserve the mystery of this guy who you're interacting with him through lawyers. You never really get to, and through his online presence and all these sort of shadows of the man, but
yes,
it's hard to get to the heart of this guy himself. And, but let's, speaking of which, let's give the start of this story its proper context. You mentioned he was this self-taught stockbroker. What was he doing before this? How did he wind up day trading?
Yeah, so Nav grew up in a pretty modest part of West London called Hounslow. He lived pretty much directly underneath the Heathrow Airport flight path. So if you go to his house, like every 5 minutes, all conversation stops because an aeroplane comes kind of roaring into the runway. And, you know, he lived in a pretty modest two up, two down. He was one of three brothers, the youngest of three brothers. And by all accounts, you know, he's a fairly normal kid in a lot of ways. You know, he loved soccer or football, you know, which everyone does in this country. And he was really, really into computer games. You know, so he used to play a lot of soccer. And then as he became a teenager, he got really, really almost obsessive about computer games, and particularly this soccer game, FIFA. And he was good at it. You know, he devoted a lot of time to it. And he ended up in the top 700 out of 3 million players around the world.
Oh, you know, well, so he's in the top 700 of FIFA.
Yeah, sorry, he was.
That's, you know, as someone who plays that game and who has friends who play it, that is, might not sound like an achievement to some people, but that is crazy.
That's, yeah, crazy. See, I don't know. I mean, I know that 700 out of 3 million sounds pretty good, but yeah, so, you know, so you can tell from that he has a couple of attributes. One is that he's very obsessive. You know, so he'll sit there and play this game for, you know, hours and hours and hours at a time. And the other is that he's quick thinking and that he's quite dexterous, you know, so he's quite good with his hands. And then the other thing is that at school he does well. He doesn't work particularly hard, but he's got some real aptitude for maths and for science. And one of the things that I write about in the book is that he has this sort of ability to do mental arithmetic and long multiplication in his head, you know, with numbers that most people wouldn't be able to do. So apparently he found this like this kid's computer game, and it was 3 years old, which is like for times tables, and he essentially sort of memorized it. And by the time he got to school, he could like multiply 4-digit and 5-digit numbers in his head. And the way that he sort of explained it was essentially, he would, you know, he wouldn't just instantly see the answers in his head, but he would almost not require a pencil and paper. It was like he could keep the workings that most people would write down in his head. So he also has this kind of photographic memory, essentially. So anyway, you know, fast forward, he goes to university. It's pretty mediocre university. He does a degree in maths, gets a few kind of crappy jobs, you know, working in a car, you know, car phone warehouse. I don't know if you have that over there, but like a mobile phone shop. And then there's an advert one day in a newspaper in London called the Evening Standard, and it says, wanted futures trainee futures traders, must work well under pressure. And Nav has, you know, had some introduction to the markets at this point, so he applies for this position. And it turns out to be what were called trading arcades. And, you know, for a long time, trading in financial futures and commodities and things like that was principally done in what were called pits. You know, so it's this sort of stereotype of guys shouting loudly at each other, wearing colorful jackets and, you know, hand signals and you know, that kind of very visceral physical exchange. But in the late 90s, trading, you know, after a reasonable period of time, had migrated onto computer screens. So no longer was it really the sort of burly or loud, aggressive traders that were sort of most suited to this type of trading. It was people more like Nav that were just gifted and intelligent and, you know, had the sort of wherewithal to learn this new type of trading. And so Nav applies to this position at a place called Futex, which is one of the first ever arcades to open up in London. And, you know, if you can imagine, it's a long way from the sort of skyscrapers of Wall Street, or in the UK, it's like the City of London, you know, where you have to have a degree from Yale or Oxford University to get in, and it's the kind of masters of the universe. This place is very different. You know, this is like a bunch of misfits in a room. They get taught how to trade, they get taught how to use the software, and then they're essentially kind of let loose with the firm's money, and the firm essentially will back you, and if you're not successful, they'll cut you, but if you are successful, they take a share of your profits. And, you know, to put it into context, probably 8 out of 10 of the people they took on would fail. Navinda just, you know, pretty much straight away found he had a real aptitude for this type of financial trading, which I describe in the book, but it's essentially called scalping. And it's nothing to do with like, oh, you know, Apple stock is going to go up in 3 months' time, or, you know, I think that gold would be a good investment because of, you know, interest rates and what's going on in the economy. It's nothing to do with that. It's to do with looking at very short-term movements in the financial markets, trying to get ahead of them and then get out again. And you're trading literally hundreds of times in a day, in and out, in and out, in and out. And Nav's kind of ability to remember patterns and his ability to focus intensely on the task at hand meant that he was very good at kind of looking at all the trades that were going on, all the buy and sell orders that were entering the market, and using that to, in his head, in real time, predict which way the market was about to move. And so, you know, I sort of document a couple of his real successful and remarkable trades. But, you know, to cut a long story short, by the time he left Futex after about 5 years, he was worth about $3 or $4 million.
Wow.
Which is, you know, which is pretty impressive for a 27-year-old with no formal training.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's kind of a lot of people right now rushing into the stock market because of, you know, the volatility caused by the pandemic. But that's sort of the dream of a lot of those people, is to do something like Nav did, which is, you know, you just make smart trades and you can become a millionaire.
Definitely. I think part of the thing that really appealed to me about this story is that when I was in my 20s, I got really into online poker. And one of the things that appeals about it is this idea that if you use your wits, if you're intelligent and you really knuckle down and learn something, then you don't have to go to work. You could just make your own, make your own hours, and essentially get rich off the back of your own smarts. And I think trading appeals to a lot of young people, particularly young men, for that reason. It's that kind of idea. It's like the golden ticket, you know, that if you work hard and you learn and you absorb it, then you too could be as successful as Nav was. But the reality is it's incredibly, incredibly difficult to beat the markets. You know, even for professionals, it's incredibly difficult. And I mean, to be fair, when Nav started trading, it was somewhat easier. And over time, you know, as more and more trading has become automated, and these kind of high frequency trading firms and others have become more sophisticated, it's really, really difficult now to consistently beat the market. But to all those people that are, you know, putting money in in the stock market at the moment, I mean, it seems like prices are so divorced from reality that you just have to sort of watch it go up. But if history is a guide, I don't think that's going to happen forever.
Well, you mentioned the high frequency traders there. What was his beef with those guys?
So if you can imagine what Nav is doing, is he is looking at all of the orders to buy and sell financial futures that come into the market. So if, for example, he sees on his screen that there's suddenly somebody that wants to buy a huge amount of financial futures, well, this is a very simple example, but what he can then do is also start buying, and the market is likely to go up because there's a huge amount of buying interest in there, and then he can sort of ride the crest of that wave. And because he had these kind of almost you know, not superhuman, but you know, he had these abilities that most people didn't have, to read the market, to react very quickly, and to sort of consistently profit. But what starts to happen in maybe sort of 2007, 2008, and increasingly over the course of the book, is that you have these market participants that enter the market called high frequency trading firms. And these are, lots of them are based in Chicago. They're principally sort of started by these old pit type bosses, but the people that run them and operate their sort of computer trading systems are like PhDs from Stanford and MIT, you know, really, really supremely gifted mathematicians and stuff. And what they do is essentially train computers to trade autonomously without or with very little human interaction at all. You know, you might fiddle around with your algorithm at the end of the day or the end of the week or whatever, but basically you're just sort of setting it loose into the market. And for Nav, what he starts to find is that prices start to move in strange ways, unpredictable ways. There's, you know, lots of orders that are appearing and then disappearing before you can actually hit them. And he becomes frustrated because he feels like the market is no longer like a level playing field. He feels that other people are cheating, and he attributes this kind of slipperiness that he's seeing in the markets to the advent of this new form of trading known as high frequency trading. Now, you know, later on HFT would become very controversial. Michael Lewis's, you know, whole book and lots of others have sort of essentially said, well, because what happened is in a fairly short space of time, these sort of tiny HFT electronic trading firms went from representing like maybe 10% of all trades in the stock market and the futures markets to more than 50% of trades. So suddenly almost every transaction passed through the hands of these tiny little firms in Chicago and other places. And they were able to sort of chisel away very small but constant profits. So, you know, in one of the years I write about in the book, these firms between them made $10 billion. And the controversy arises because it's sort of like, well, you know, what's the sort of social good of having a very fast market participant jump in front of your trades and then sort of sell on to the other party? Like, what good does that provide to wider society? These HFT firms will say they provide something called liquidity, which means that there's always somebody there standing ready to take the other side of the trades. And they argue that they actually sort of shrink prices and are actually sort of beneficial to other market participants. But what's you can't doubt is the fact that they are very, very profitable, and particularly at the time that we're talking about in the book. But anyway, you know, I mention all of that because that's what everyone knows HFT for. But for people like Nav, these day traders, it wasn't so much a sort of altruistic concern about humanity at large. It was more like, these guys are sort of eating my lunch and it's pissing me off. And so right. That's the point where he sort of makes this decision that he wants to do something about it.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned Michael Lewis's book, and I had read that, and he talks about the high frequency traders being people who essentially, if you want to sell something for $10, they learn the fact that you want to sell for $10, and then they buy up whatever it is you're trying to buy and then sell it to you at a premium. Like, that seems totally, I'm sure there's some arcane justification, like liquidity or whatever these people say, but that seems totally screwed up, right?
Yes. I mean, a couple of things to say. One is that Michael Lewis's book was principally about the stock market, you know, so buying and selling shares in companies, and NAV and the sort of context of my book is principally about the futures market. And so even though HFT is just as prevalent, some of the tactics that they're, and the sort of shenanigans that you see in futures are different to what you see in the stock market. That's the first thing I'd say. But ultimately, it is, you know, you are right. Essentially, what these firms are doing is using very sophisticated computers, very fast technology to essentially analyze all the orders that are coming into the market, statistically determine the probability of whether the market's likely to go up or down, jump ahead of it, and then profit, as exactly as you say, for selling it in the example you gave for a dollar more. And yeah, for a lot of people, including very, you know, very smart people, it's hard for them to sort of see what sort of benefit that provides wider society. But, you know, to be fair, there is a lot of sort of counter arguments to that, principally from from the HFT community. But, you know, and to be fair, there are, you know, there is evidence that some of their claims are true.
Right.
It's just, is it necessary to be as pervasive as it is? So for example, there's a firm that's mentioned in the book, and when it comes to market to IPO, in its IPO documents, you know, where it's looking to list on the stock market and it's looking for investors, it says that it had, I think it's one losing day in like 1,600 days or something. So it had like one losing day in more than 5 years. And that kind of thing sort of talks to a market that isn't necessarily set up in an equitable way if you've got participants that literally can't lose.
Right. Yeah, no, and especially for a guy like Nav, I can understand how he feels like the little guy, you know, locked out of what feels, if not illicit or illegal, it feels a little shady. And so did that lead at all to him feeling like, you know, oh, well, if the big boys can get away with that, maybe I can get away with what I'm doing?
Yes, definitely. I think that Nav already had this slight anti-authoritarian chip on his shoulder. You know, he wasn't an outsider in the sort of real sense. You know, he came from an immigrant family with very few advantages, you know, went to a pretty mediocre school. He's got a very strong London accent, didn't have a lot of privileges, didn't have any money. And you know, the world of high finance is as much about who you know as what you know. And so in a sort of very real sense, he was sort of locked out from that world. And you know, it's almost sort of comedic when he goes to this job interview for Futex, because he sort of like, he speaks like this, he says bruv all the time, and he sort of makes these sort of like comments that make the people there laugh. And they take him on. But if he was to do that at JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs or, you know, any of these big firms, he just wouldn't have got a sort of foot in the door. And so he almost has to crowbar his way into the firmament. And he does it with incredible aplomb. But yeah, I definitely think, you know, he had this kind of existing anti-establishment sensibility already. And then, yeah, so the other thing, you know, that comes across and that is another reason why people are sympathetic is that he complained a hell of a lot about other people cheating to the people that owned the exchanges where he was operating and the regulators. And he would, you know, take videos and send them in and say, look, look what's going on. These people are placing massive orders and cancelling them. These people are pushing prices around. And they just didn't do anything about it. They didn't believe him. And when he sort of almost started experimenting with those type of things, they didn't stop him doing it either. And so for somebody like Nav, who, you know, seems to view the world in quite a sort of black and white way, it was almost like a green light for him. You know, they say one thing, but actually in the real world, you're allowed to do whatever you want. So, you know, to hell with it. I'm going to just do it.
Right. So what exactly does he wind up doing?
So, in about 2009, Nav reaches out to his software provider, which is a big company called Trading Technologies, and he asks them if they can make some changes to his trading software that will allow him to do some things that he wasn't able to do before. And specifically, what he wants to be able to do is, if you imagine that, like, other market participants, and particularly these kind of automated firms, what they're doing is responding to signals in trading data. So if a load of, as I, in the example I gave earlier, if a load of people suddenly start putting orders in to sell, say, you know, a Apple stock, the computers will look at that information and at all sorts of other information and determine, well, you know, there's suddenly a glut of sellers, the price is likely to go down. And so for that to work, that sort of relies on the orders that are entering the market to be legitimate. And Nav kind of worked out, well, if I start messing around with the signals that the robots are receiving, I can get them to trade in ways that I actually want them to. And so what specifically he starts to do is he builds this algorithm which will place very, very large volumes of sell orders into the market. But then he sort of sets it up in such a way that as soon as the price moves, his orders will be cancelled and then they'll be reissued again at the new price. So sorry if this is getting a bit sort of tricky, but upshot of what he's doing is he's essentially deceiving other market participants about which way the market is about to move. And then simultaneously to that, he's trading himself. He waits for the move, which can, you know, last for as little as 30 seconds or less. And then once the market's moved, he'll cancel his what become known as spoof orders, and, you know, get out the other side. So he starts basically messing with the information that he's giving out to the world about his intentions to trade, in order to trick what by then were principally sort of algorithmic competition.
And at this point, was what he was doing, was that stuff that was mimicked at all by the high frequency traders, or was he going totally rogue?
There was definitely a huge amount of speculation at the time that this was going on by high frequency trading firms. One of the things, you know, that definitely comes across is that Nav didn't really know who he was up against. And actually, he didn't actually know that much about the way that the world of finance or the world of futures trading actually works. And when I say the world of futures trading, I don't mean like what's happening with prices. I mean how the exchanges operate, who the people are that are there, how the rules are set. Like all of that stuff was kind of abstract and not required for him to sort of play his computer game of guessing prices. And I'm sorry, Duncan, I've lost my train of thought there slightly.
No problem. So basically what I was wondering is he's doing all of these complicated maneuvers to sort of, like as you said, spoofing, where he pretends to be selling a bunch of things at a certain price, the market reacts to that move, and then he cancels those orders and then sells them at the price that he really wants to sell them at now. And so he's making a big profit. But what I'm wondering is, was he the because obviously yes, he's run into legal trouble.
Yes.
And there, he seems to be of the mind that he was not the only one
definitely
conducting himself in that way on the futures market. Is that true, or is that sort of a convenient self-defense?
So I'd say it's both. It's definitely true that lots of people were also spoofing at that point in time. And there's this great email that I include in the book where he goes on one of the trading forums and he just complains bitterly about what he's seeing in the market that he's trading, which he describes as spoofing, which at that point wasn't a very sort of common word. But essentially it just means to place orders that you don't intend to actually execute. And he would see that all the time. And nobody would seem to get in trouble for it. So, you know, as a result of that, he took it almost like a step further and decided to build an algorithm that would do this in a much more systematic way and on an almost industrial scale. Now, the thing about HFT's methodology is, you know, it's lots of people would argue it's just as pernicious, or at least not as kind of beneficial or having a point. But these firms are very sophisticated. They have got compliance officers, they've got lawyers on hand, so they know where the letter of the law is.
Yeah.
And they're pretty careful to stay just on the right side of it. And Nav, on the other hand, famously, when he was first approached for doing this, turned around to the CME, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and told them to kiss my ass. So had quite a different, approach to the authorities.
Okay, so I want to get to the point where there's his downfall. But before that, how much money was this guy making?
Sure, yeah. So he gets this algorithm built for him, and after some teething problems, it starts to work just incredibly well, better than it's got any right to. You know, by this stage, he's left Futex. He's working in his bedroom, the bedroom that he grew up in his parents' house. They're downstairs, got no idea what he's doing up there. And he, starts to make really, really serious money. So I catalogue a week in the book where one day he makes $450,000. The next day he makes $800,000. The next day he makes like $950,000. You know, so he's making sort of up to $1 million per day.
God, that is so crazy.
I sort of talk about in the book, but it's kind of hard to imagine, because another really sort of twisted element to this whole thing is that he just obviously didn't tell anyone. So he's sitting in his room essentially printing money and nobody knows about it, and he doesn't tell anyone, and he's just sort of sitting there with that information and just doing it day in, day out. But the kind of, I guess, the inciting incident in my story and in Nav's life is on May 6th, 2010, which is the title of the book, which is a day that came to be known as the flash crash.
Okay. And what happened there?
So May 6th, 2010 was a pretty volatile day in financial markets. It was the midst of what was called the Eurozone crisis. So, 2 years earlier, you had the financial crash with all Lehman Brothers collapsing and all of that stuff. And the kind of fallout from that was still playing out in the markets. And in 2010, you had Greece that was on the verge of collapse. You had all these European countries like Spain and Italy that were having to go to their government and essentially be bailed out. And there was just, huge tumult throughout the markets. And that day, Nav was trading and he was just firing sell orders into an already falling market. And the market was just collapsing, and the extent to which he had any kind of impact on the fall is a sort of major topic of the book, and I'm sure we'll get to it. But either way, he was sort of making money hand over fist. And then at 1:40 p.m. Central Time, Nav turned off his computer. By then, he'd made I think it's $950,000 that day. And then exactly 1 minute later, the U.S. stock and futures markets started crashing faster than they ever had before. So within the space of within a space of 4 minutes, the S&P 500 had lost 5%, which is about $1 trillion of value. And if you look at like the price chart for that day, it just looks like a cliff face, essentially. Yeah. You know, the market's down and then suddenly it just falls. And then what happens is that the futures exchange freezes all trading. So for 5 seconds, nobody's allowed to trade. Everyone's, you know, computers and human beings are kind of waiting for the market to reopen. And then almost just as bizarrely, the price starts to recover again. And within about 20 minutes or half an hour, the futures markets have almost recovered to where they were. And then there's this weird period in which like US stocks, so Apple stocks, for example, are temporarily trading at hundreds of thousands of dollars, but other stocks are trading at like a fraction of a cent. So prices were just completely all over the place. And then they start to recover as well. And within, you know, an hour, if you looked at, you know, if you sort of stepped away from your desk for an hour and then come back, you might not know anything had happened, but it turns out to be this real watershed moment in financial markets, because it suddenly alerted the general public and also the US government itself to the fact that markets had changed a lot, you know, under their noses, and actually more and more trading was done electronically by computers that didn't have any human interaction. And it really became this big sort of question mark as to whether that was the right way for markets to be run, and whether this thing that they got away with this time could happen again tomorrow, and what that would mean for people's savings and their investments and the price of, you know, commodities and things like that. So it really became almost like a sort of a canary in the coal mine type moment in the history of markets.
Okay, so there's a number of things I want to address there, but the first one pertinent to this story is, at what point did people start pointing the finger at Nav and saying that, hey, you, this guy living in your parents' basement, trading by yourself, you're the fall guy, essentially? How did he get blamed, whether or not that's valid?
Yes. So there's a kind of flurry of attention on financial markets after May 6th, 2010. And the main US financial regulators, the SEC and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which looks at futures, they announced that they're going to do a big deep dive into exactly what happened that day. And they're going to produce a report. And then there's various hearings where senators like interviews major players within financial markets and try and get to the bottom of exactly what happened and try and, you know, allay people's concerns as to whether it could happen again. And what the regulators do fairly quickly is that they discover that in Kansas City, there is a very large kind of, I don't want to say cumbersome, but, you know, a pension fund that day, amid all the volatility, had almost lost its bottle. It had big investments in stocks, and it decided it was going to hedge its position, which means that it essentially wanted to offset its exposure to a rising stock market because it believed that the market could start to fall again. And so they sold a huge amount of financial futures, but the way that they sold them was pretty arguably reckless. They put this very large sell order in. They didn't put any kind of base at the level of price that they're willing to accept. And they almost like pressed go on their algorithm at exactly the wrong time. And they sold $4 billion of futures into a falling market. And so when this official report comes out, it sort of points the finger at a number of things. It points the finger at the rise of high frequency trading. It points the finger at all these macroeconomic things that I talked about. But it also very strongly suggests that the trading of this Kansas City fund had been a major catalyst for what happened that day. But there was no mention at all of, you know, a guy in his basement in London. And it's only 2 years later when another day trader, who's, you know, somewhat more sophisticated than Nav, I guess, you know, he trades with a bunch of other people. He knows the markets incredibly well, and he uses computer systems, to trade. And he decides that he's going to backtest his new trading system on a particularly noteworthy day. And so he sets, he looks at May 6, 2010, almost on a whim, and he notices what nobody has noticed, throughout the story up until then and all the people that looked at it. He notices these blocks of sell orders that are hitting the market and then leaving the market. And we're not talking, a few hundred thousand dollars. You're talking NAV was placing $200 million of sell orders and then canceling them using his mouse at home. Yeah. And so this other trader, who in the book I call him Mr. X, he identifies this and he's like, hang on a minute, why is nobody talking about this? Why has nobody noticed it? And he becomes pretty convinced pretty quickly that it's manipulation, that somebody is trying to push the market down. And so he's recently read an article in the paper which talks about this new whistleblower program that's just opened up in the US at that point, where basically if you blow the whistle on somebody for doing something wrong and it turns out that there's a case and that person ends up getting fined, well, you can actually get a percentage of the monetary reward. So he then goes to the CFTC with this evidence and says, look, I believe that there's manipulation going on that day. And that kickstarts a bigger investigation. And, ultimately that leads to the door of Navinder Sarau in Hounslow. But I mean, to be clear, like the US authorities, and later on it involves the US Justice Department, because it turns out that what he was doing wasn't just, a civil offense, but was actually a felony. So the FBI gets involved. But at that point in time, all they know is that Navinder has made something like $70 million, that he's put money in various offshore locations, that he's quite aggressive when he talks to the CME, the exchange, and that he's got this firm called Nav Sarau Futures Limited. So they've got no idea who they're dealing with. They just assume, because of the size of his trading, that this is some sophisticated hedge fund with a huge amount of backing, financial backing. And it's only when they, they arrive in London, and it's this sort of opening scene of my book where they all sort of rendezvous at a McDonald's at 6 o'clock in the morning in Hounslow, all these police cars, and they kind of, in the dawn light arrive at this house in Hounslow. And it's only when they knock on the door and Nav's dad answers and sort of shouts upstairs, Navinder, there's some people downstairs to see you, that they realize, the true just bizarreness of the story, that it isn't this criminal mastermind. It is literally, a guy in his bedroom who, used to play FIFA and now plays the markets like a computer game.
And this, just to be clear, this is going to be made into a movie at some point. Yes.
Well, listen, it was amazing to do the book, but quite early on in the process, before the book had been published or anything, my agent knew Dev Patel's agent, fantastic actor, and he actually grew up not too far from Nav. He's almost exactly the same age, and he read, some of my chapters, and he'd read the treatment for the book, and he was just really fascinated and into the story, and just, loved the character of Nav. I think he said it reminded him of his cousin. And so he signed on to star as Nav and to exec produce a film. That was a while ago now, and yeah, there's a screenplay, and, I sometimes get emails and it all sounds great, but, I don't want to get too excited because lots of stuff gets quite far along in that process and never actually happens, but I think it would make such a great movie.
Oh God, I hope it gets made, because just that scene that you're describing right now begs to be seen in some movie theater somewhere.
The other element of the story which we probably shouldn't get into too much now, but which makes it a more cinematic story, is that at some point, as Nav sort of starts to accumulate more and more money, he gets targeted by various kind of money men who are introduced to him by his accountants. And so then you have Nav, not just in his bedroom, but you have him being flown to Zurich to meet these money men who are trying to entice him to put his money in various schemes. And there's another scene where he goes to see the head of private banking at Goldman Sachs and turns up in a, you know, in a sort of leather jacket. And so, you know, to your listeners, it's not just a guy in his bedroom. Like, he is out in the world and being himself, which is, you know, which is great value.
Well, okay. So let me ask you this then. He's making upwards of $70 million at the time he gets caught for this. But he's not spending it wildly. He doesn't appear to be living this luxurious lifestyle. I can perhaps wrap my mind around a guy who is making that much money legitimately by just being a really good trader and who it just is doing it for love of the game. I mean, it sounds maybe a little like far-fetched, but I can wrap my mind around it. A guy who's doing this illicitly, who's tricking the market, who's cheating at the game, and doesn't, like, it seems at that point that the only reason you would do it is for the spoils. But help me understand this now. Like, where's the
discipline? So I definitely think Nav was all about the love of the game. Like, he was a pure trader, and it was what, you know, kept him up at night, and it's what he did day in, day out, you know, almost at the expense of anything else, you know, a kind of major social life, any kind of relationships. He was just obsessed with trading. And, you know, it's not easy to say, but, you know, in the book, Mr. X, for example, takes the view that Nav is just a cheat, and, you know, he doesn't really understand all the attention that he gets. But to me, even though what he was doing was ultimately illegal, there was something almost beautiful in its ingenuity about it. And the fact that he executed it so well, and you know, I think talks to his love of trading. And I think that he believed that what he was doing was ultimately justified and was no different to what his competitors were doing. And to him, I think it was validation of his superior skills. And just seeing the numbers grow on his screen was enough for him. And, you know, it probably won't be a huge surprise, but he later gets diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. And I think, you know, once you know that, it does sort of change the prism through which you sort of view some of his decisions, because they're just completely perplexing to most people. But for Nav, he had this sort of simple life where he used to play with his nieces and nephews in the garden. He used to watch football matches. He's got a bike, you know, a bright yellow bike with a Lamborghini sticker, which he called his Lambo. And he, you know, would drive around Hounslow, and he had a very simple life, and he didn't want to lose that. And so trading for him was almost a private thing that he did that tested his abilities. And it was never about proving to the world how great he was, or the sort of material side of it. And I sort of wonder on some level whether if he had really started spending the money, then it would make it all the more real, and he would have to sort of face up to the fact that, you know, he was fucking with, you know, financial markets that affect a huge amount of people, and also ultimately landing himself in trouble, because he does start to get, you know, hints that people are looking at him, and rather than slowing down, he just continues on. And it's that kind of behavior which I think is really hard for most people to wrap their head around. That's what makes Nav. Yeah.
Does he get to keep any of this money? Because I have to say, even though he's doing, you know, it's not something to be cheered on, there is a part of me, and I'm curious your feelings on this, but there's a part of me that is rooting for this guy when reading the book, because I want him to be the guy who gets the escape latch at just the right moment, makes his money, and just quits. Obviously, that doesn't happen.
Yes.
Does he get to preserve any of his earnings?
Yeah, so I do agree with you, and that's one of the frustrating things, because there's so many opportunities he would have had to have, like, as you say, pulled the plug and spent his days in Mauritius, you know, sunning himself. But he just was never going to do that. He was like headed for a brick wall and accelerating from the very start. So one of the sort of major twists of the book, without giving too much away, is that he gets arrested and then he gets taken to a police station, and the judge says, well, how much has he made? At that point, they were aware that he'd made $40 million. So they set bail at like $5 million, which should have been fairly easy for him to get hold of. And they can't get hold of the money. And he gets a lawyer, and the lawyer takes on the case thinking, this is brilliant. You know, this case is really high profile. The guy's loaded. This is going to be a fantastic case. But when the lawyer starts to sort of chase down where Nav's put his various investments, it starts to become clear that he can't get hold of the money. You know, people stop answering the phone, or they find out weird details about, you know, what he's done with it. And so Nav actually ends up staying in prison for several months. And eventually the judge kind of goes easy on him and says, look, we'll set bail at $50,000. And so Nav's parents have to put up their, you know, their family home as surety. And, you know, ultimately Nav ends up getting fined $38 million, you know, vast amount of money, but he has made considerably more than that. But the tragedy of the story is, and I don't want to give the game away, but he's unable to access any of that money. And so
is he unable to access it, or is he just, you know, with a nod and a wink, unable to access
the ultimate, it? The ultimate trick. Well, listen, that would make a great ending for the movie. But, you know, if you ask me, honestly, I don't believe that's the case. And part of the reason for that is because there's a big part of the book where I investigate the people that he sort of gets into bed with. And they are essentially, particularly one of them, is a known Ponzi schemer and a con artist. And so in Nav, they find the ultimate patsy, because not only is he able to make money almost on demand, but he doesn't spend it. So essentially Nav gets, you know, suckered into all these various schemes, which range from things like, you know, quinoa farms in Peru and wind farms in Scotland, like a sort of online gaming company. All these people sort of metaphorically knock on Nav's door and say, Nav, when you put your money in this, we'll give you a 10% return, you can't lose. And he's just, you know, with no use for the money, just says yes to almost all of them. Yeah. And it, you know, that you said earlier that you sort of end up rooting for him. And I really think that that's, that again talks to that. How, you know, having said all that, there was a time after his arrest when he was like the greatest market manipulator in the history of the futures markets. And he was staring down the barrel at 22 criminal counts of fraud and market manipulation that between them carried, I think it's 380 years in prison. So he was really in a very, very difficult place. And ultimately he ends up avoiding all of that. And so in a lot of ways, I feel like he had a very good outcome considering what happened to him.
Yeah.
I
mean, what a whirlwind though, to get yourself caught up in, to just ascend to that height and then drop way back down and you don't have anything to show for it.
The thing I love is that the story starts in his bedroom and it ends in his bedroom. And it's like, it's almost like it was all a dream that,
yeah,
exactly. You know, that all of this happened and yet he's in no different a position as he was at the start.
Okay, so we're almost at an hour here, and I don't want to keep you for much longer, but the last thing I wanted to ask you, because you did write another book called The Fix, which is all about how the LIBOR number was rigged, and it appeared that there were fewer cases of accountability as opposed to what we have in Nav's case. Did you draw any parallels between those two books in terms of like institutions not receiving a lot of punishment, whereas lone wolves sort of getting the brunt of the law?
I mean, that is definitely a characteristic of white collar crime enforcement, because essentially, you know, the firms that were involved in LIBOR rigging were the world's biggest investment banks. You know, it was like UBS and Deutsche Bank and JP Morgan and others. And ultimately what happens is that, you know, their traders get found to have come together on chat rooms and agreed to rig this important number to benefit themselves. And you know, my book focuses on one individual who, like Nav, actually does sort of bear the brunt and actually ends up facing a very hefty, and some would argue too hefty, prison sentence. But for a lot of the banks themselves, you know, they essentially negotiate with the regulators a fine. And the fine, whilst it might sound large, you know, might stretch into the hundreds of millions, even, you know, $1 or $2 billion. If you look at the profits and the revenues of these firms, is really very, very absorbable. And so I think, you know, one of the big differences is that the fix is really about the sort of institutions at the heart of finance and the fact that, you know, I guess one parallel is that regulators to a large extent are kind of way less powerful than the parties that they preside over in terms of their knowledge of what goes on, but in terms of their resources as well. And so you kind of end up in situations where the financial cops are always one step behind, always chasing the previous crime and not the new thing that's going to happen. And also very much are sort of beholden to settle these cases and get some kind of result, as opposed to really sort of go down hard. And, you know, there's a great financial book called The Chicken Shit Club. But that the subject of that is exactly that, which is, you know, after the financial crash of 2008, the fact that nobody ends up going to prison for fraud tells you, you know, a lot about how financial markets are policed. And that's definitely a theme of both books. But the other thing I would say to that is that, you know, I was lucky enough to spend a lot of time with the individuals at a lot of these financial regulators that do these investigations, and I can tell you that, you know, almost to an individual, they're really, really hardworking and intelligent people that are constrained by the system rather than any kind of lack of aptitude on their part.
I think that's a good note to end it on. Liam, thank you for your time. And is there anything that you want to plug before we head out here?
Not really. You know, just obviously if people haven't read the book yet, then please go out and buy it. It's called Flash Crash. And what I would say is that, yes, it is ultimately a story about the financial markets, but it's really a human story as well about a guy who succeeded, you know, against very difficult odds and ultimately ends up sort of getting taken down by forces that are bigger than himself. And those sort of themes are, I think, anyone can really relate to. So I hope that it's got a real sort of universal appeal in that respect.
Absolutely. And God, I really hope that movie gets made.
Thank you, man.
Alrighty. Take care.
Nice one. Cheers.
Thank you to Liam Vaughn, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.